Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
We seem, you know, born to love one another. That, I mean, when you somebody gets in a crisis, their mind goes to the people they love. This is just what we do. So that's wonderful. And then also, there's this train coming down the track with the word death on it for everybody, for you and for the people you love. Those things seem so hard to reconcile. And now what I do mostly is just deny the death part. It's going to happen to everybody else, but not to me, because I have this special exclusion from God. So the book asks the question, how in the world did Lincoln get up and move on after this death of his son? Everyone hated him. He was screwing up. But for me, it opened another question, was is it possible to maintain a positive, loving stance in the world, knowing that it's all going downhill in a material sense? And this is something I've been interested in this since I was a little altar boy, you know, this idea that death is real and love is real. What do we make of that? You know, certainly you could just walk around in cringing fear. You could walk around in denial. But I met people in my life who were able to actually, sounds strange, but who were able to use impending death as a source of joy. In other words, the party's ending at midnight. That doesn't mean it's not a pretty good party.
The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. The judicious and pragmatic words of President Abraham Lincoln in a message to Congress in 1862. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What does it mean to live a good life? Can grief and suffering transform our moral consciousness? And is it possible to let go? Well, on tonight's show, I'm going to tackle those questions with two unique and talented voices. One an American, the other an Australian. Writers of tremendous insight, sensitivity and originality. George Saunders reimagines the death of President Abraham Lincoln's precious son, Willie, and Hannah Kent unpacks The Good People, published by Picador. This is a show about political leadership, parental grief, and the psychology of folk and fairy lore. But first, blame and guilt are the furies that haunt houses where death takes children like Willie Lincoln. And in this case, there was more than enough blame to go around. The hypnotic words of George Saunders from his latest novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, published by Bloomsbury.
Hi, my name is George Saunders. I'm a short story writer, and I've just published my first novel. It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. I'm also a teacher of creative writing at Syracuse University in the U.S. The book basically tells the story of Abe Lincoln going into the crypt of his late and beloved son, Willie, back in 1862. The book is set all in one night in the graveyard, and it's narrated primarily by ghosts with an occasional punctuation by historical sources. So I'll read from a chapter here. About noon, the president, Mrs. Lincoln, and Robert came down and visited the lost and loved one for the last time together. They desired that there should be no spectator of their last sad moments in that house with their dead child and brother. They remained nearly one half an hour. While they were thus engaged, there came one of the heaviest storms of rain and wind that has visited this city for years, and the terrible storm without seemed almost in unison with the storm of grief within. In Witness to the Young Republic, a Yankees Journal, by Benjamin Brown French, edited by D.B. Cole. During the half hour the family was closeted with the dead boy, lightning cleaved the dark sky outside, thunder as terrible as artillery fire made the crockery shudder, and violent winds charged in from the northwest. Epstein, opposite. From throughout the spacious halls that evening, great sounds of grief could be heard, not all emanating from the direction of the room where Mrs. Lincoln lay insensate. The president's deeper groans could also be heard. In My 10 Years at the White House, by Elliot Sternlett. A century and a half has passed, and yet it still seems intrusive to dwell upon that horrible scene, the shock, the querulous disbelief, the savage cries of sorrow. Epstein, opposite. It was only just at bedtime, when the boy would normally present himself for some talk or roughhousing, that Mr. Lincoln seemed truly mindful of the irreversibility of the loss. In Selected Memories from a Life of Service, by Stanley Honer.
Really well done in the book, George. It's such a curious, imaginative, and quite a soul-searching read, to be honest. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
We might start off with the title of the book, Lincoln and the Bardo. I'm just wondering, what does a bardo mean to you? How do you understand it all?
Well, the bardo is just a Tibetan term for a transitional space. So we're actually in one right now, the transition between birth and death. But in the sense of the book, the bardo is the one that starts at the moment you die and goes to whatever is next, whether it's reincarnation or heaven or hell. Heaven for us, but you know.
So it's an in-between state. Why did you choose to talk about this transitionary phase to develop a narrative about Lincoln?
Well, it was kind of the other way around. I had heard this story that Lincoln had gone into his son's crypt, and it just for about 20 years, it just captivated me. I couldn't quite commit to writing it, but I couldn't forget it either. So then in starting it, it just became clear that the best way of narrating it was with a chorus of ghosts. So then as a Catholic, former Catholic, or maybe still Catholic, the idea of purgatory presented. But somehow this space seemed a little more transactional. You know, in my South Side of Chicago, Catholic history, purgatory was like, you know, go sit on that hard bench until the end of days and we'll see what happens with you. But this space seemed a little more freeform and also more dependent on if the spirits could make adjustments along the way, they might have a happier outcome.
So there was more negotiation, if you will.
That's right. And self-negotiation to see if one thing is these ghosts don't know they're dead. That's a big issue for them. Also, each of them has one issue that they can't quite get over that's stopping them from going on to the next thing, as I suspect we all do. So part of the as the world evolved for me, it became clear that these ghosts had to come to some reckoning with their own phenomena in order to get free of this place that they're stuck in.
What's interesting about the novel is that Lincoln isn't the main man in the novel by any means.
No, and I was terrified. For years, I tried to just avoid him. He's like writing a novel about Jesus or something. It's so big that this doesn't sound like very much fun. But then when I realized that he was just a bit player, really, he was going to come in and out as needed. And I just had a kind of mantra that the emotional power of that scene of him holding the boy's body was what the book was all about. So he's part of that, but he's not the entire thing.
Would you describe the novel as a father-son narrative or possibly within that an exploration of grief and suffering? Because you've got so many ghosts who have a lot of demons that they're trying to understand and realise and accept.
Yeah.
And then you have Lincoln trying to reconcile the loss in war and his own personal grief.
Yeah, Lincoln's kind of in a bardo himself because to be honest, my approach to a book like, or to any book, any story, is just not know much at the beginning. I have a kind of a reductive, simplistic mind. And if I have a plan for a book, what tends to happen is I just do the plan and then it's a disappointment. So my feeling was I love that initial idea. It seemed charged with love and emotion and sadness and all that. Then I proceed kind of intuitively and technically just to say, okay, how do I start to tell the story? So all the things that the book grew to be was because of a series, like thousands of intuitive decisions at speed. So then you kind of look up from that and you go, oh, wow, I made this complicated thing. And actually, I'm only reading it again myself to see what I've done, you know. So to me, the primary artistic move is to say, I don't know. I'm not sure. And almost like in a river, if you were in a canoe and you were looking to have a lot of fun, you might steer towards the rapids. So as I'm writing, that's kind of the feeling that any complexity I can achieve comes from abandoning control, actually, and abandoning, especially conceptual control, thematic ideas and so on. Whenever I get into those, I get into a bit of trouble.
But presumably that's a very exciting space to be in as a writer. And also within that, you know, to allow the book to steer you and allow the ideas to take you on a little bit of a journey also.
Exactly.
Because you were asking quite a lot of big, heavy questions in this novel.
Yes. Yeah. And some of them I didn't know I was asking until I asked them. But the thing that that excites me about artistic work is that it presumes that there's a mind state that is real and is accessible. It's reliable, but it's not the one we're in every day. It's not the one I'm in right at the moment. Right now I'm working from the top part of my mind, you know, kind of responsive. But if I can go into a writing room for 4 or 5 hours a day, the mind quiets down and you become very aware of these truths coming from somewhere else. So not in any kind of mystical way, but just almost reliably, there's a part of our human ability that we don't use except in this artistic space. And it yields amazing complexity, in my case, much more complexity than I could pre-manufacture, if you will.
So what were you trying to figure out as you were writing the book? Because I said there's a lot of big questions in this novel. One is on how we understand our suffering, and then within that, how we let go of our suffering.
Right.
You've teased out the bardo. So I'm just wondering, what did you resolve? Or is it possible to resolve anything as you write?
Well, it's just mostly what you're trying to resolve is, for me, is the mechanics. Where are people standing? What is a thought they could have that would make sense and be truthful? Then out of that, you start to, what I took away from this book was how completely transient everything is. This building, you, me, the day outside, especially our thoughts about the world, they seem solid in the moment. But when you look at a stretch of history like this, you see how everything changes. Buildings go away, dreams come and go, the things that we love pass. And so as I was working with the book, that kept coming in, this idea that you could have an historical event described by four different people in complete contradiction. You could have people who were making a great case that slavery should be preserved and a great case that had to be torn down. So kind of like, and this might sound silly, but the vision of life that I have now, having written this book, is like, you know, a million people on ships at sea, and the ships are covered with ice, and they're flailing about, and they're all drunk, you know, something like that. That's reality.
You've sprinkled in some real historical texts and also some fictitious imagined stuff. And from the reader's perspective, it's very, very interesting. And you're trying to figure out what's real and what isn't. Mm. But you can steer the reader in lots of different directions and also poke and play in different ways.
Yes. Well, when I first started the book, I thought I have to be faithful to Lincoln, the Civil War, the bardo, even the geography of the graveyard. And about halfway through, you realize that's not what a novel is. A novel is a much more risky proposition. As a reader, you're saying to me, I'm going to hand over my trust to you. I don't care about the small things, but I want you to tell me some transcendent truth at the end. Even better, the reader wants to have an experience that is irreducible. So you come out of the book going, whoa, almost like a roller coaster. Mm. Jeez, what was that? Mm. You know. Now, 10 minutes later, you start to analyze it. You know, this is a good part of the roller coaster. This is a boring part. But when I'm reading, I want that pop that comes in the first hour after reading where the world is transformed, everything looks different. So if you're trying to deliver that, that has to be the sole focus. So about halfway through the book, I said, I'm going to make a completely fictional graveyard because I need it. I'm going to take history and I'm going to play with it a little bit to produce the maximum emotional effect. And then you get into some really interesting territory.
But within that narrative, you are writing about the Civil War. It's the context of the Civil War. You have one of America's most iconic figures. He's seen as a great moral leader, a very courageous, brave person. You've touched on areas in relation to slavery, violence, lots of other dark, murky areas in American history. Did you feel in some way within that some accountability to some truth?
Yes, for sure. And in fact, when I was inventing these things, it was never arbitrary invention or invention with some distortive purpose. But for example, you would read 15 books about a certain battle, and then you'd have 2 pages to summarize it. So if you were strictly just excerpting the historical text, you wouldn't get the truth. But if I could sort of distill all that and then use my fictional abilities to create the perfect little nugget. So I would say most of the invented ones were in the service of historical truth, but also in the service of compression.
Now, Mary Lincoln's grief was very, very real, and it's developed upon in Lincoln in the Bardo. Can you talk to me a bit about that?
Well, some people said she never recovered from this. And of course, then 3 years later, Lincoln was killed as well. So she went into kind of a spiral in her life. She ended up penniless and
she lost a lot of other children as well, didn't she? She lost several children.
Yes, she lost a baby before this and Tad after. So it was an incredibly difficult life. And again, she's not a big player in the book. She's actually home. And Lincoln only, he sort of thinks of her just at the end. He's been in this intense, maybe 4-hour grief period. And he thinks, oh, God, I've left her there alone. But during the time of the book, she's actually at home, medicated and kind of just in an incredible, you know, spin of grief.
As I mentioned there a minute ago, you've alluded to some historical texts, diaries, newspapers and so on. And one of the ones that you've used is the London Morning Post. I might just quote it to you because it's a very interesting take on Lincoln and how he read the Times. It was, "Lincoln will not go down to posterity as a man who could not read the signs of the times, nor understand the circumstances and interests of the country. He'd no political aptitude and plunged his country into a great war without a plan and failed without an excuse and fell without a friend."
It's a very loaded interpretation of history and of Lincoln. Clearly, there's a big difference between Lincoln and the 45th president of the United States. So I'm just wondering, the novel has been launched at a time of a very interesting presidency in America and of two very, very different breeds of men. So
that's a very polite way to say it.
You started this novel five years ago, and nobody could have foresaw that we would have the likes of Trump in the White House. Presumably now, that has given a certain feedback or kick into your novel in some way, because as readers read and go through the words, you're looking at a presidency and looking at how he used power within his presidency, because it sprinkles throughout the book. Mm-hmm. So whether it's moral leadership or political leadership, that has possibly organically grown as you were writing this novel. So how does that feel?
Well, the one thing that I came away from the book, I finished it about a month before Trump started to make his ascent. And at that time, the thing that really struck me was how still America is a work in progress. Lots of high ideas that we keep failing to execute, especially in terms of equality and so on. So I came out of the book kind of, the country has sort of come out of amber and into reality again. This is a place that could still do great things. And then I actually went on the campaign with the Trump people for the New Yorker magazine. And it was really interesting to see that a lot of the issues that started in the Civil War have never been resolved. The Reconstruction was botched afterwards. And so these issues are very, very much alive. And it seems to me there's kind of two visions of America. One, the one that I believe in, is that it's got to live up to the Constitution. All beings are created equal. Mm-hmm. That has huge ramifications, spiritual ramifications, political ramifications. The other one is much more, I would say, provincial, you know, mm-hmm. the idea that we already know who we are. All these people who are different are coming in for a slice of the pie, and we might consent to give them one. That's not what the Constitution mm-hmm. says. The Constitution says the pie was theirs from the beginning. Mm-hmm. We only misunderstood whose pie it was. Mm-hmm. So it's a very lively time in the States, as you can imagine. But I'm actually feeling a little hopeful, because there's a lot of people who never gave politics a thought on both sides mm-hmm. are suddenly energized. And so I feel like it's a bit like a goiter that's going to burst. This mm-hmm. this thing was in the road. Unfortunately, you know, there were a lot of systemic problems in America, especially with income inequity, that were causing stress for everybody. I would have been very happy if Bernie Sanders got in, because he understood that very well and had a very compassionate solution. Unfortunately, we got a little more of a president with a strange energy. So it's anybody's guess what will happen.
But it's interesting, if Lincoln had lived and hadn't been assassinated, and then the different trends that history would have taken. I wonder what he would make of America today, in terms of America has not evolved into that wonderful post-racial society that was hoped for and so desperately hopes for.
He predicted it, actually. Mm. He said something about that America would not be destroyed from without, but from within, which, you know, who knows. But he also said that if America continued to exclude the slave, then that was just a door opening to exclude immigrants. That he actually said that. So it's not a new story. There was a party in his time called the Know Nothing Party, which was all about the right of white Americans, and it was excluding the, you know, Irish and the Italians and anybody who, that wasn't sort of hadn't been there a while. So it's an old story.
Arguably, though, Lincoln was as ambitious as Trump is today. They both display other types of instincts, that massive political ambition and that idea to change.
Yes. And also, you know, I mean, I was at a reading the other day, and a guy stood up and his first question, this was in D.C., was to just read a list of things that he hated about Lincoln. You know, we think of him as this beloved figure, but he did. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus. The federal government wasn't really a thing until he took over. And you know, here's a guy who tens of thousands of young men were dying every day because of blunders that he and his administration were making. So I think his death probably, you know, cast a saintly patina on him. But even now, there are people who think he was a bad president.
Can I ask you about Roger Bevin, one of our lost souls? As I mentioned earlier, you sprinkled in some terrific ghosts or souls, or they're almost like a Greek chorus, if you will. And there's lots of very comic chattering and muttering, some wonderful philosophy sprinkled, I might add, all the way through. Roger says something on the lines of, our grief must be defeated. It must not be our master and make us ineffective. It must not put us deeper into the ditch. They're beautiful words. Yes. Very hopeful, aren't they?
Yes. Well, and I think that's, you know, as I was writing the book, one thing that I kept coming back to was this crazy conundrum in life. We seem, you know, born to love one another. That, I mean, when somebody gets in a crisis, their mind goes to the people they love. That this is just what we do. So that's wonderful. And then also, there's this train coming down the track with the word death on it for everybody, for you and for the people you love. Those things seem so hard to reconcile. And Now, what I do mostly is just deny the death part. Mm. It's going to happen to everybody else, but not to me, because I have this special exclusion from God. So the book asks the question, how in the world did Lincoln get up and move on after this death of his son? Everyone hated him. He was screwing up. But for me, it opened another question, was is it possible to maintain a positive, loving stance in the world, knowing that it's all going downhill in a material sense? And this is something I've been interested in this since I was a little altar boy, you know, this idea that death is real and love is real. What do we make of that? You know, certainly you could just walk around in cringing fear. You could walk around in denial. But I've met people in my life who were able to actually, sounds strange, but who were able to use impending death as a source of joy. In other words, the party's ending at midnight. That doesn't mean it's not a pretty good party. You know,
it's an excellent analogy. Presume you've read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying.
I have.
Yeah. And what did you make of it?
Well, it was very difficult. And I'm a sort of an aspiring Buddhist. And I thought, boy, this is way beyond me. And also one of the things in that description of the bardo is that it's not the case that you can step into it and start making decisions. Mm. I mean, it really is like going over a water slide in a theme park. Depending on how you've prepared yourself spiritually, you're going to have more control or more autonomy in that realm. And, you know, I had an experience about 10 years ago where I was in a plane that almost went down, and one of the engines went out, and there was quite a bit of panic on board and black smoke coming through the things and people screaming. And I had been meditating pretty often then, and I noticed that I was not in any way prepared. You know, I always thought I'd be the guy who stood up and said, everyone, let's say a prayer of gratitude and go to our deaths with a smile. And I was not that person at all. So,
an angry Buddhist, is that it?
Well, a terrified Buddhist, for sure. Yeah.
I was very interested in how you presented Lincoln's empathy and his sense of love and his understanding of his own personal suffering and what he wanted to do with it. Mm. Because how you've presented him is that he really wants to understand his grief and he wants to work through it.
Yes.
And you present some very moving scenes. Do you think as a writer that is something that you can do so much better than as a, let's say, a writer of fiction as distinct from an historian? Because you have Lincoln at his son's grave, lifting him up in his arms and very sensitively touching his face and embracing his son and embracing his own grief. It's not a place a historian can naturally go to. So I'm just wondering, what was the plan there?
Well, partly that, you know, I guess when you're doing a novel, especially about a historical figure, you're doing some percentage historical reality. And then, of course, you're kind of just taking yourself and pouring yourself into the vessel that is Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So for me, the book became about the way that sorrow, you know, the true sorrow, when you've lost control of everything, and something that you really didn't want to happen has happened, that can be, of course, lead to bitterness. Mm. But in Lincoln's case, I supposed it could lead him to a kind of wisdom. So in other words, most of the time, we're going through life with a lot of walls up, a lot of control. So I'm a good husband, a good father, a good writer, blah, 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 you know, all these things. Sometimes the world takes those away. Then what do you have? And in this book, I suppose that when all those things are gone, there's a kind of crazy wisdom that might take over, where you really are seeing things clearly because there's no motivation not to. And I've had moments, you know, when someone that I've loved has died, where it feels like a curtain has dropped around you, and you see the world for the fierce, beautiful thing that it is. Personally, I can't stay there too long. Thank goodness the curtains come back up after a little bit and things get normalized. But we're looking here at Lincoln when the curtains are down for him. And he makes either a choice or maybe just by disposition, he sees sorrow, not only his own sorrow, but he sees other people's sorrow. And that is a kind of a strength that he takes away.
He clearly processes his grief.
Yes.
Which is an amazingly admirable thing to do.
Well, and he was, you know, one of the things I did to prep for the book was I just read as much of his speeches as I could. And you see, he's always working logically. He's got a very syllogistic mind. So I suppose that even in that moment of grief, that habit would be intact. Mm. So he would say, I'm feeling this. Why am I feeling it? What can I do with it? Is there any reasonable way out? If there's not a reasonable way out, what must I do? And he actually thought that way about slavery and about politics and everything.
It's unbelievably rigorous and logical and intelligent. It's amazing how you can have these principles in your working life and apply them at such an intimate level in your personal life,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And he seemed to be able to master that, which is so impressive.
Yeah, I think it was for him almost a neurologic habit, or it might have been from
an
his
aptitude
youth.
Of some sort.
Yes, and his youth was one of extreme chaos. And so you can imagine young Lincoln trying to make some sense out of all of the madness around him and retreating to this inner place. Now, and we've made that a cliche about him reading, you know, walking 7 miles to borrow a book, but you can feel the person who is, you know, his father was rough with him. Just an incredibly poor frontier life that we probably can't even imagine the squalor of it. And this little boy who had quite an extraordinary mind trying to maintain a little bit of a fire within it.
Do you think he really worked from a place of deep intention?
Yes, I do. Yeah. When you see the things that he did, for example, he would be very happy to play the clown or to play the loser in a political interaction. If he had to look like a hick, you know, he was happy to do it. If he had to look like the big boss, he was very good at working with circumstances to get a positive outcome, which, you know, there's certainly in spiritual traditions, there's an example, someone who's always for the good of others.
George, Reverend Everly Thomas, he pitches up some extraordinary questions throughout the narrative, and it really pushes it to the reader to make their own sense of the world that they live in, and I suppose make sense of their own experiences, because you're drawn into so many different moral and emotional questions within this story. But he asks, how should men live? And how did you live? They're huge questions.
A huge question. Yeah. That's what literature is for, I think. The small questions we can ask over coffee, but the big ones, you know, how should we live? What's the role of love in our life? You know.
But presumably you're pitching that out to the reader, but you're also asking yourself as you're writing it, were you?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And one of the, you know, I'm a big fan of Chekhov's, and one of the things that Chekhov does so beautifully is he'll ask a big question like that. He'll pose a big question. So in a story called Gooseberries, he asks, is happiness a good thing or a bad thing? He has one character answer it at great length. Happiness is evil. It's not a good thing to strive for. Another one answers it. Happiness, of course, is what we live for. Then we turn to Chekhov to say, well, which of those answers is right? And he says, yes, they're both. And, you know.
So what are you hoping the reader to do with Lincoln and the Bardo? Because it is a story, but there are so many stories within the story. And I'm sure different readers will engage with it in different ways.
Yeah.
Are you hoping to create a sort of a dialogue of some sorts on how we're living today and how we're understanding and empathizing within the world?
Yes, but I don't know what that conversation looks like. I mean, my thought is, my job is to generate energy during the 5 years I'm running it and transfer it to you somewhat intact, and to have some kind of feeling of lighting up in you. That's really as far as I would go.
Yeah.
I can talk more, but that wouldn't be truthful.
But you're extending the perspective of the reader in some way by doing that.
Yes, I think so. I think that's a part of what happens. But as a creator, it's really a feeling of trying to take something, cause it to flare up to life, hand it to you, have some of that life come into you. The side effects might be that you feel, I mean, ideally you'd feel a little more alive, but also some readers feel angry. They don't like it, you know? So I think from the creative perspective, you're just making energy and transferring it. And of course, you kind of know, I mean, as you're working, you're rereading, and you know on a subconscious level what questions you're asking, and you shape the narrative to ask those questions more aggressively. But at the end of the day, it works best for me to see it as a kind of a process which you can't actually speak about. You can reduce it afterwards, but during it, it's very much an intimate conversation with an imagined reader. And intensity is the word I always think. I want it to be intense.
And ultimately, you have to let it go and give it to the reader.
That's
and
right.
Put it out there
and start a new one.
I was interested to hear that you have an audio book coming on stream.
Yeah, it's the book is a series of monologues. And so when I was asked to read the audiobook, I thought, oh my God, I can't imagine doing 300 pages in this Chicago drone that I have. So we actually went out to actors and we got 166 different voices to do it, including actors like Susan Sarandon and Nick Offerman, Julianne Moore, but also my mother, my father, my kids, my wife.
But it's bursting to be read out and out. It's very difficult to just sit still with the book.
Yes.
Isn't
it's a
it?
Bit, it's a bit of a radio play, and
it is.
I've heard it, and it's quite interesting, quite beautiful. Yeah.
Just lastly, the book ends on a very hopeful note that love may yet be ours. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, it happens every day. And if it doesn't happen, we try to get it to happen again.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. I might get you to finish off with a reading. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Lovely.
And I'm going to read here a section that has two voices, and I'll just pause between the two rather than try to do the different voices. So in this section, two ghosts are going to come near Lincoln, and in the convention of the book, if they enter into his body and the three occupy the same physical space, they can actually read his mind. So here these ghosts are going to approach him and then decide to enter his body and sort of channel his voice, kind of ventriloquism. He tried to see his boy's face, couldn't. Tried to hear the boy's laugh, couldn't. Attempted to recall some particular incident involving the boy and hoped this might. First time we fitted him for a suit, thus thought the gentleman. This did the trick. First time we fitted him for a suit, he looked down at the trousers and then up at me, amazed, as if to say, "Father, I am wearing grown-up pants." Shirtless, barefoot, pale round belly like an old man's, then the little cuff shirt and buttoning it up. "Goodbye, little belly, we are inshirting you now." Inshirting, I do not believe that is even a word, Father. I tied the little tie, spun him around for a look. "We have dressed up a wild savage, looks like," I said. He made the growling face. His hair stuck straight up. His cheeks were red. Racing around that store just previous, he had knocked over a rack of socks. The tailor, complicit, brought out the little jacket with much pomp. Then the shy, boyish smile as I slid the jacket on him. "Say," he said, "don't I look fine, Father?" Then no thought at all for a while, and we just looked about us. Bare trees, black against the dark blue sky. "Little jacket, little jacket, little jacket." This phrase sounded in our head. A star flickered off, then on. Same one he's wearing back in there now. Huh. Same little jacket, but he who is wearing it is... I so want it not to be true. Broken. Pale broken thing. Why will it not work? What magic word made it work? Who is the keeper of that word? What did it profit him to switch this one off? What a contraption it is. How did it ever run? What spark ran it? Grand little machine set up just so. Receiving the spark, it jumped to life. What put out that spark? What a sin it would be. Who would dare ruin such a marvel? Hence his murder anathema. God forbid I should ever commit such a grievous. Something then troubling us? We ran one hand roughly over our face as if attempting to suppress a notion just arising. This effort not proving successful, the notion washed over us.
That was American novelist, teacher and short story writer George Saunders. Lincoln in the Bardo is published by Bloomsbury and retails for in around €18 in paperback. Now I have to say, hats off to George. Lincoln in the Bardo is a terrific read. It's lively, inventive and hugely humane.
Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Nance knew that the only reason they had allowed her this damp cabin between the mountain and wood and river for 20 odd years was because she stood in for that which was not and could not be understood. She was a gatekeeper at the edge of the world, the final human hymn before all fell to the wind and shadow and the strange creaking of stars. She was a pagan chorus, an older song, People are always a little afraid of what they do not recognise, Nance thought. The unsettling and evocative words of Hannah Kent from her latest novel, The Good People, published by Picador. Well, earlier in the month, Hannah was in town to promote The Good People. And I put it to her, is it fair to say that we were all driven in some way by a quirky set of beliefs, superstitions and rituals?
Undoubtedly, I think. I probably would have said so before writing this book, but certainly more so now, having spent, you know, a number of years thinking about this very thing. I think for a lot of us, you know, a lot of human behaviour stems from sort of two primary motivations, either love or fear. And I think a fear of the unknown or a fear of being unable to control what is yet to come is really behind a lot of the things that we engage in. I think a lot of rituals stem from the idea that perhaps they're connected to a particular effect. You know, we want to put the cause in place, and so we find ourselves doing everything within our power to bring about a desired effect, whether or not we know for sure that's what's bringing it about.
What was the big question you were asking yourself when you set out to write The Good People?
Well, I came to The Good People quite by accident rather than design. I actually discovered it's based on a true story, and I learnt of this true story when I was researching my first book. My first book was set in Iceland and required the translation of a lot of Icelandic sources. And while I sort of have a mediocre fluency in that language, it was still a very tedious process. And so one afternoon, to give myself the afternoon off, really, I started reading some old British newspapers. And as I was reading these newspapers, more for fun than anything else, I stumbled across this brief article from 1826, which detailed the crime and trial of a woman called Anne, or Nance Roach. She was accused of murder. And her defence was so extraordinary that it sort of stopped me in my tracks. She said that she couldn't be held accountable for what had happened because she was a fairy doctress and she was only ever trying to cure a fairy-struck child. She said that she was trying to banish a changeling. Now, I had sort of encountered this changeling story, or the changeling mythology, if you will, before, but I never really considered it to be something that could intersect with reality in such a shocking way. And so I immediately wrote down this article, and years later I thought, I still have so many questions. And I think my initial questions, like you ask, were probably to do with this woman. You know, was this something that she sincerely believed in? Is this really what had guided her actions? Or was it instead something that she was saying in order to get off? Was she trying to appear superstitious, or was she trying to appear simple-minded or ignorant? And if so, was she any of these things? And that was really the beginning of what ended up to be quite a few years exploring Irish folklore. And of course, you never really find your answers when you're guided by questions. You just come up with more questions. But that's probably where I started.
But it's very understandable to consider that if somebody lacked education, how they could explain certain mysteries, or how they would explain certain uncomfortable things in their life through a superstitious belief.
Absolutely. Well, this one of the first things I did when I decided to research this particular event, because at this early stage, I didn't know if the book was going to be heavily sort of based on fact, or whether it was going to take that story as its premise and then be largely imaginative. I found the most wonderful book written by Angela Burke, an Irish writer and academic, called The Burning of Bridget Cleary, which is certainly the most famous instance of someone being thought to be a changeling and you know, suffering as a result. And in Burke's book, she writes so beautifully of the way in which superstition could be a vernacular, particularly superstitions regarding fairies, could be a vernacular with which people could discuss things in society which were largely taboo without actually mentioning what the problem was. And that really resonated with me, and it gave me a huge amount of insight into what could have been in this particular instance.
Paganism up against Christianity looms large very much in the novel, and I think it was Father Leahy who pedals up on his bike every so often to preach to all his community about the dangers of different superstitions and pagan beliefs. How did you go about researching that? Because clearly the Catholic Church in Ireland at the time were working in very covert ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I ended up reading a lot about Biddy Early, who's probably the most well-known wise woman, the wise woman of Clare, as she's often known and referred to these days. I read about her because it's one of the few, when I say documented, I mean really through historical anecdote, and and sort of informal anecdote and social history. It's one of those sort of more well-documented cases of a priest speaking against someone who was engaging essentially in ancient folkloric customs. Biddy Early was someone who practiced herbal medicine. She was said to have knowledge of the fairies, that she spoke with them, that she could cure people of ills that the fairies had inflicted. And there's quite a bit of dialogue that has been recorded, whether or not this is, you know, verbatim, I'm guessing not, but recorded about the way in which the priest went up against her and the sort of language they used to I guess point out to the communities that what they were doing, what they were engaging in, was unchristian. But what I was also really struck by was that this was a time where, especially in rural areas, belief in the fairies and belief in God or Catholicism was really, they weren't two separate things. This was very much one and part of the same worldview. It was woven into the same fabric. And I wanted to portray that at this moment where, of course, the church is, like you say, covertly trying to disentangle the two separate belief systems and renounce one particularly.
Well, it makes for a very interesting reading, but whether it reflects too well on the church or not, I don't know. But Nance, would you describe her as a witch, a white witch, or how would you describe her?
Well, witch was something that I discovered very rarely came up as a word or as a way of sort of describing particular women who occupied this societal role where they were largely outsiders. They might be a midwife. Mm. They were a handy woman. They were there when you needed, like I say, herbal medicine, or you had recourse to them when things were not going well in your life and you had need of someone to help you often negotiate the liminal phases of life, whether that be birth or death or childbirth.
But they were outsiders, Hannah, because they didn't culturally really integrate with society. They lived outside the village. They were, you know, called upon when people felt vulnerable in their lives, whether they're having marital problems, or you said the big life moments, midwifery and so on. But in some ways, they were never fully trusted, or people were never fully certain of them and their role.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And this really struck me because in Biddy Early's case, what I seemed to notice was that she understood, I believe, that she could never be one of the mob. You know, she was never really part of the community in that way. But she almost relied upon her eccentricity and her status as outsiders so that people would believe in her power. And I think that probably became a necessary evil for people to, perhaps they acquired this particular role through being an outsider anyway, or through having certain eccentricities. And then they found a need to further cultivate that status in order for them to, again, be able to use that to their advantage.
You present a very haunting picture of Nora Leahy, our lead protagonist. She has lost her husband and she's also lost her daughter within a space of a year. And she's a very vulnerable woman. She lacks education. She lives on the margins. And how you show her vulnerability within the village and within greater things in society. It's very gripping. I'm just wondering, would you describe that as speculative biography, or what would you describe it as?
I don't know if I would describe it as speculative biography. In my first book, when I was writing about this woman, Agnes Magnusdottir, who was the last person to be executed in Iceland, I did call that a speculative biography because I was working very much from a skeleton of fact that I had been able to research and corroborate and sort of establish. In the case of this novel, all I had really were two newspaper articles. All I had was the conclusion. So my portrayal of these characters, though they borrow the names of their real-life counterparts, are entirely imagined. That said, I do use my research into the broader societal or political or cultural climate of a place to inform the way in which my characters are and to also inform the ways or the trajectories of their narrative. And with Nora's case, on one hand, I was looking at things very particular to her as an individual, as a character. I wanted to look at the ways in which grief can really undo a person to the point where they no longer almost recognise themselves and they're unwilling to perhaps face the darker side of their character that maybe grief has brought out of them. But on another, at a more removed distance, I wanted to look at the way in which a woman survives in a society without a strong kinship network. I wanted to look at the way in which the limited options and choices that women often had at that time, when combined with poverty, and there's no doubt that these women were poor, mm-hmm. What would that do to someone who's in very trying, very intense sort of psychological trauma, what would happen? I don't think Nora is a particularly likable character, and I never intended her to be so. She's someone who perhaps we can feel very little sympathy for, but I nonetheless wanted to encourage an empathetic response based on that understanding that she is a woman who has very little recourse, very little agency in her life.
And she's very clearly overwhelmed by grief and is desperate to sort things out. Psychiatric issues loom large in the novel, and it's alluded to throughout the narrative that different women in the community are having mental health problems, whether it's postnatal depression, issues related to sexual dysfunction of some sort, and some other stuff. Just wondering, how did you go about looking into the history of psychiatric issues in Ireland, because it's a very grim story told in this novel?
Yeah, I did do some reading. To be honest, I didn't do as much reading as I would have liked. I think I realised quite early on that none of the women in the society of which I was sort of attempting to represent would have been admitted to an asylum. Also, there wasn't really a contemporary a dialogue in that particular sort of rural community about mental illness. It was still something which I believe was spoken about in abstract terms. And like I said earlier, might have been incorporated a fairy vernacular or a supernatural vernacular as a way to address that there was a problem and to maybe try to find a way to react to it or to solve it, but was nonetheless not, there wasn't really a lot of medical discourse I could find. So when I realised that there was never really going to be an opportunity for these women to be put in an asylum, or that nothing was going to be so, I guess the issue was never going to be able to be portrayed in obvious or direct terms. I didn't necessarily go into it in terms of what was available at that time. I was very interested, and my thoughts were very much shaped by that early reading of The Burning of Bridget Cleary. Burke does a much better job than I of articulating the ways in which, particularly to even changeling, the changeling mythologies, but other discourse about people being swept by the fairies or taken or changed by them might have stood in as a way of acknowledging that people were, as we now understand, suffering from mental illness.
One of the more haunting and uncomfortable aspects of the novel is the issue of disability. Mm. And Nora's grandson is disabled and he's hidden from the community and he's almost a ghost in the novel. Mm. Can you talk me through that?
Well, I knew that Micheál, the child, would be quite a central figure. His, as I understood it from the original newspaper articles, he was a child who had once been well and now could not talk, could not walk. They might not actually have even said that he was once well. What I did find, though, in a lot of the cases where people believed that a child was no longer their child but a changeling, there was often there was a pattern, and one of the things that emerged in this sort of pattern of stories was that the child appeared well and then was suddenly no longer that way. And so I wrote Micheál as exactly that, a child who, when Nora last sees him at 2 years old, meets him for the first time, is developing as a normal child should. And yet when she sees him again at 4 years old and becomes his sole carer, he like I said, he can no longer talk, he can no longer walk, he acts in a strange way. And she, I think Nora, who at this moment is undergoing a huge and overwhelming grief, she sees in this child, she projects, I guess, a lot of her frustrations and her anger onto this child because he is a vulnerable target. In portraying him, however, as a child, it was difficult, and I struggled a little, especially in the earlier drafts, because a lot of, you know, I'm a contemporary person living in a modern society. We privilege a particular kind of scientific rationality. It's very difficult for us to talk about a child who is behaving in this way without wanting to diagnose him. And initially, writing him down, I had read a lot of essays about where changeling stories had been examined by doctors and people had looked at the descriptions of changelings and retrospectively attempted to make diagnoses. And people have come up with suggestions of cerebral palsy, meningitis, autism, all sorts of things. And my initial temptation was to almost select a disability and to use the symptoms of that disability as a way to describe Micheál without ever naming anything. I wanted the reader to align themselves in some ways with Nora's, you know, she's completely taken aback. She does not understand these changes. She doesn't know why it has occurred. I didn't want there to be an easy diagnosis available to a reader. So I deliberately confused Micheál's symptoms. And with that, I suppose I wanted to try and encourage an understanding that faced with something that you cannot explain, that you cannot control, that is a burden on you, that is preventing you from, I guess, living a happier life, as undoubtedly would have been the case for many families, certainly not all, and with someone in, I think, more specifically in Nora's position where she feels so utterly disempowered, she starts to fixate on this child. She starts to project her longing for a happier life on this boy. If she can convince herself that he is in fact a changeling, it also means quite significantly that she believes that there is her original grandson, you know, something of her daughter out there waiting for her.
Australian novelist, critic and editor Hannah Kent. The Good People is published by Picador and retails for just under €21 in hardback. And if you like the sound of Hannah's latest book, you may also be interested in Hannah Kent's award-winning novel, Burial Rites, set in Iceland. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the thoughtful words of George Saunders from Lincoln in the Bardo. Oh, the pathos of it, haggard, drawn into fixed lines of unutterable sadness, with a look of loneliness, as of a soul whose depth of sorrow and bitterness no human sympathy could ever reach. The impression I carried away was that I had not seen, not so much the President of the United States, as the saddest man in the world. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.